Iran's army and the IRGC kick off large-scale military drills using the country's indigenous air defense missile systems. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country can only defend its skies if its Western allies provide Kyiv with fighter jets. North Korea's leader orders government officials to engineer what he calls fundamental transformation in agricultural production amid fears of food shortages. Thanks for joining us. Iran has kicked off massive aerial drills with the aim of assessing response to possible attacks on the country's key defense and nuclear installations. The spokesman says air defense units of the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps are taking part in the joint exercises. Brigadier General Amir Abbas Alamdadi says the air divisions on the first day of their maneuvers focused on detecting hostile objects and electronic simulation to intercept them. The general says they would also practice establishing safe connection of multi-layered communications with the integrated air command and control network to make timely decision in the event of threats. The Army and the IRGC are using indigenously made systems and weapons in the drills that cover more than 1 million square kilometers of Iranian airspace. Russia says that it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty until the West changes its attitude toward Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman said that NATO has now turned into Russia's enemy by arming Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov added that the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of the security of another. Last week, President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's decision to suspend participation in the New START treaty. He cited Washington's failure to keep its end of the bargain and its deepening involvement in the Ukraine war. The U.S. called the move deeply unfortunate and irresponsible. The New START treaty was signed between the U.S. and Russia in 2010. Puts a limit on nuclear devices and the means of their delivery. Russia has accused the U.S. and other Western countries of disrupting its relations with Africa. Russia says the move by, quote, the collective West is aimed at isolating Moscow following what it calls a special military operation in Ukraine.
The U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of this special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally.
The U.S.'s approach toward Russia comes at a time when millions of Africans appear to be fed up with Western presence on their soil. That can be highlighted in recent anti-West sentiment in such countries as Burkina Faso, where protesters demanded immediate withdrawal of French forces. With anger growing in Africa against the West, it seems that the era of Western colonialism is taking its last breaths.
The visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance. In the words of Pender herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pander argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seem to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West imperialism.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Geneva to attend the 52nd regular session of the UN Human Rights Council. Amir Abdollahian has held talks with several high-ranking officials, including the UN Chief Antonio Guterres, on the sidelines of the summit. The correspondent Gisomi Shahmedi joins us now from Geneva to tell us about the top Iranian diplomats' schedule for today. Gisu, what do you have for us?
Hi, Kaveh. I'm standing right outside the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. We're waiting for our foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, to arrive any minute to attend the 2023 conference for disarmament. So this is a very important conference regarding disarmament around the world, and our foreign minister will be delivering a speech in this conference. He will also have some more meetings with on the sidelines of this event, and I will keep you posted on that. But as far as the UN Commission for Human Rights is concerned and the Council for Human Rights, which we attended yesterday, I have to mention that some very important issues were raised by the foreign minister. Particularly, he uses a specific word. He said that Iran has been a victim of terrorism laundering. Now, that was an interesting term coined by the foreign minister of Iran in a speech that he delivered in English, specifically to be able to deliver this concept, terrorism laundering. And that was what happened over the past couple of months in Iran, and the support that terrorist groups and rioters received from foreign countries, particularly some foreign television networks, interestingly, in the UK and in the US, who not only supported terrorist activities in Iran and rioters in Iran, but also even trained them and gave them information, gave them logistic information on how to keep on rioting and acts of vandalism in the country. This was one of the most important issues that was raised yesterday. Also, alongside that, the significant role of Iran as a country that has had a very long history in fighting terrorism was also pointed out by the foreign minister. And, of course, what was actually carried out by the martyr, General Qasem Soleimani, was also pointed out by the foreign minister. And also regarding the issue of Palestine, the foreign minister pointed out that Iran will always support the Palestinian cause, and not just the Palestinian cause, but anywhere that human rights is being violated, Iran and the Islamic Republic will definitely support those who are a victim of a violation of human rights. Also, as you mentioned, alongside that conference yesterday, the foreign minister held some very important bilateral meetings. One of the most important bilateral meetings was the one with Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, a very friendly meeting in which some very important issues regarding the nuclear deal was also raised. And of course, Iran did mention that it is prepared to continue the negotiations with all the parties of the nuclear deal. Aside from that, Kaveh, it was very interesting for us to see that the foreign minister of Belgium and the foreign minister of Norway and the foreign minister of Finland came to the hotel to visit the Iranian foreign minister. And this was despite all the propaganda against the Islamic Republic and the fact that these countries are adamant in working with Iran and expanding their bilateral relations with Iran. Actually, the meeting with the Belgian foreign minister was quite a lengthy meeting. Also, on the sidelines, the foreign minister visited the missions in Switzerland, and also today we're expecting some more bilateral meetings to be held. And aside from the very important speech that we're expecting in an hour, I will be keeping you posted on the rest of the events.
Thank you for that. Giza Mishahmedi there, live from Geneva. Moving on with the news, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterates his plea to his Western allies to provide his country with fighter jets to defend the skies.
Our pilots and anti-aircraft units and other experts of our Air Force are doing a great job, but we will be able to completely protect our skies when the aviation taboo is fully lifted in relations with our partners.
Zelensky's request to shore up his country's air forces comes as the West remains undecided to provide Kyiv with warplanes. Ukraine has been given billions of dollars in military aid by its Western backers. The West and some European countries also announced to equip Kyiv with their main battle tanks. Washington has said that it will send an additional $1.2 billion in financial aid to Kyiv. The announcement was made by the U.S. Treasury Secretary during her visit to Ukraine. Janet Yellen said the U.S. would also press for more action from its allies to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. Washington has been the biggest supplier of arms to Kyiv since the war broke out. The Russian military has intensified its attacks on the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut in the Donetsk region to take control of it. According to Ukraine's military, the Russian army has surrounded the city in a bid to force Ukrainian troops to surrender. Ukrainian commanders say the situation there is extremely tense due to constant Russian shelling and the attempt to cut the supply lines. Meanwhile, the Russian army said it had targeted an ammunition depot and shot down U.S.-made rockets and Ukrainian drones. The capture of Bakhmut would pave the way for Russian forces to take control of the last remaining urban areas in the region. Ukraine says there is no sign that China is mulling transfer of weapons to Russia despite U.S. claims. Head of Ukraine's military intelligence, Kirill Budanov, also expressed doubt that the Chinese officials have even talked about the issue. U.S. officials recently accused China of considering providing Russia with lethal military equipment. Beijing denied the claims, saying it is the U.S. that is sending arms to the conflict zone, not China. It also slammed Washington for imposing sanctions against its companies over allegedly providing intelligence to the Russian army.
The actions of the United States have no basis in international law at all, nor are they authorized by the UN Security Council. They are typical illegal unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction which seriously damage China's interest. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposed to this and has lodged stern representation with the U.S.
Mao also vowed resolute countermeasures by China. The spokesperson added that the U.S. must stop spreading disinformation and withdraw sanctions on Chinese companies. China has repeatedly called for peaceful resolution of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. It has also recently unveiled a 12-point position paper on the political settlement of the crisis. Geopolitical analyst Jeff Brown earlier joined us with his take on China's initiative to settle the Ukraine crisis, as well as his thoughts on Western military support for Kiev.
There are things that Russia would not agree with in the 12-point plan. There are things that Ukraine would not agree with in the 12-point plan. But President Orban of Hungary supported it, and it has gotten a good reception outside of the what I call Euranglo land, the West and Israel. So it has been a success from a diplomatic and media standpoint for China. I would say that the NATO, the generals, and the American Joint Chiefs of Staff are absolutely delusional. Either that, or they're putting up a good face for the public by saying we're winning and Russia's losing. And this is an existential battle between the West, basically, and the East: Iran, Russia, DPRK. China and the global majority versus the NATO, global minority, what I call Euranglo land, Israel and the West.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has called for a fundamental transformation in agricultural production as the country is reportedly grappling with food shortages. Kim emphasized the importance of stabilizing agricultural sector, saying that hitting grain production targets this year is a top priority. He didn't elaborate on measures the country would take, but he said the changes need to happen over the next few years. Kim was speaking during the second day of a key party meeting on Monday. His remarks came weeks after South Korea's unification ministry claimed that there had been reports of starvation deaths in the north. Pyongyang is under strict international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. This has been compounded by a self-imposed border closure by North Korea since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. And that is for this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the 8-year Holy Defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view an approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family units and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. He would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriya High School and studied grade 7 there, and 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the Imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool. According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, the main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB. The IRIB president says that some of the anchors were ladies and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors. Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Tomatoes, bell peppers, cucumbers, and several other vegetables are being rationed across the United Kingdom, along with some fruit in some stores. Who or what is to blame for this crisis? Well, depending on who one asks, the answer can range from the cold weather in Spain to increased production costs to bureaucratic red tape, as well as high energy costs, thus less production in greenhouses. Whichever the answer, the reality is that for now, attaining these vegetables will be more difficult. But the bigger question, is this just a one-time crisis, or is it a sign of increased food insecurity, especially as the Ukraine-Russian war continues and affects both the energy and agricultural sectors?
Tomatoes, one of your five a day.
Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food producing organisations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Pourreza, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, economist and author Steve Keen. And out of Edinburgh, Mick Napier, activist and commentator. Welcome both of you to the program. I'd like to start off with Steve. I mean, there have been a range of shortages in the UK, and this latest one now deals with vegetables. What do you make of the overall shortages? What do you think is behind it?
Well, of course, as you said in your introduction, there are a lot of disparate forces that have caused it, Brexit being one, shortage of labour to pick vegetables in open fields. But I think the one which is going to be the longest impact and the most important is the rising cost of energy. That's been inflated again by another unusual event, the Ukraine war, but and an availability of Russian energy. But this is going to be a continuing trend, and really it's the energy cost of production which is rising and which will continue to rise that's going to be the most damaging factor, forcing rationing upon the country.
Yeah, and speaking of rationing, I mean, Mick, how does this affect the psyche of the average Brit, knowing that they're limited in their buying? Not only that, and of course, with the costs, that the way the costs are increasing.
The average Brit's an elusive creature. Different people are paying very different costs, very different prices for the current situation. Your introduction was very comprehensive, and the economist in London has added something of great value. But I think we need to see this war as a war of choice has really pushed up energy prices. It's also pushed up the cost of fertilizer, and it looks like this will continue into the foreseeable future. There's no end in sight. And for many Brits, this, of course, comes on top of, it's not separate from, you know, there has always been food rationing, but in the last few years, it's been by cost. And many, many British people have seen 16% rise in basic food inflation, the cost of basic food. And now you see in one of the richest countries in the world, about one person in nine reports that they have used a food bank because they were unable to buy the kind of food that they wanted over the last year. So people are paying, they're paying the cost of many, many things. The food chain is so fragile and so very, very long, not just to Morocco, but even beyond bringing stuff to British supermarkets, because British supermarkets have sought to knock every penny off the price that they have to pay producers. They've gone to Morocco because it's cheaper than in the Netherlands, and that has led to fragility in the food chain. So we see now, because of not just very unusual weather patterns, which are almost certainly due to global warming, but we've seen also crises in agriculture around the Mediterranean. In Britain, we have massive quantities of water. We have more than enough in most places, but in the Mediterranean, The aquifers, the water table is being exhausted. The River Po in the north of Italy is over 3 meters below its minimum measuring point, more than 3 meters below where it usually is in the hottest part of summer. So the water table is being used up. The model of intensive agriculture in order to push down prices as low as possible and feed the voracious maw of British supermarkets is a contributory factor to this. And ooh, British farmers are beginning to flag up the fact that they have been pushed into a crisis by the constant pressure, the downward pressure on the cost of food.
Well, Steve, is this food rationing indicative of overall economic deterioration of life as prices are soaring? I mean, how is this affecting the overall quality of life?
The quality of life has been challenged by the ridiculously bad distribution of income in this country, and that's been accentuated by 15 years of austerity policies, which really cut back on the income of the poor far more than they affect the rich, of course. And so you had, in effect, you had rationing by price of some substantial time. Now it's so extreme, you can't let those prices rise. People will be starving, unable to buy food at all of it when entirely through in the price system. So physical rationing is coming in, and I think this is going to be the flavour of the future.
Well, Mick, you talked about this war of choice. I want to look at this. I mean, is it that the UK and other European countries have basically just shot themselves in the foot when they could have tried to force the hand of Ukraine to sit down and negotiate with the Russians? They're so gung-ho about this war that is backfiring on themselves. How do you see it?
I think we need to be cautious about the metaphor of shot themselves in the foot. We have to ask who themselves are. Some people are making hay during every war produces great opportunities for some people, the arms companies and various other corporations, and they've never had things better. We've had what the mainstream media here have called obscene profit levels in energy companies, multiplied by, I think, two or three. My economist friend can correct me if I've exaggerated that. But some people are doing very, very well. But, of course, the majority of people have to pay for this war. And while NATO and Russia are ripping up Eastern and Eastern Europe, obviously contributing to the longer-term crisis of global warming, we also then have to pay. Everything is connected to the rise in energy prices and the rise in fertilizer prices, where Russia plays a crucial role in world exports. And that is a price which our rulers are simply telling us we have to pay. Now, as a friend has also said, this builds on top of a couple of decades, actually, of endless austerity. So that young people, even not so young people in the job market, as compared to myself, They have an experience of nothing other than austerity. Previous generations saw things getting better and better and better, could look forward to a generally improving standard of living in this country and many other countries. But now, increasing numbers of young adults and not so young adults continue to live with their parents because they don't want to, but they cannot afford, they cannot even afford homes for themselves. And there are many other measures of the quality of life. I mean, this is a very dirty country. It's lawless in the sense that dangerous chemicals are being pumped into supposedly protected rivers, beauty spots, and of course nobody goes to prison. So yes, the quality of life is deteriorating. Not only that, it's widely seen to be deteriorating. And a lot of people no longer use the phrase Great Britain. They use other adjectives.
Well, Mick, let me stay with you because you just talked about something I want to look at a little bit closer. You're saying that there are a few that are definitely profiting from this. Are you saying the powers that be are willing to destroy the majority of British people's lives just for the sake of their own profits? And if so, are we seeing any kind of backlash from the people themselves about all of this?
Well, there's certainly a backlash. There's a reckoning on the way. But it's come as no surprise. It's shocking, but not surprising. The most loved and the most treasured aspect of British political and social life is very probably the National Health Service, which I used last month and did not pay $20,000 as I would have paid in the USA for the service I got without anybody ever raising the question of money. That is being privatized at an alarming rate, and people know that. Right across the board, we see, as our economist friend mentioned, and he's an expert where I am not, incredible inequality. The production of billionaires on a huge scale at one pole and the production of poverty at the other pole. And we see people, you know, having to choose between, as the phrase goes, heating or eating. It's cold at the moment in Britain, and a lot of people have to choose between enough food for them and their children and heating their homes. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is widely known and widely acknowledged. And the very popular perception, reflected in opinion polls, is that this government simply doesn't care. It is in hock to vested interests, which are very wealthy. It is corrupt in many, many ways, coming out in scandal after scandal. And yes, they're quite prepared that we pay the price for their war of choice. And it looks like we will be expected to pay the price while they make fortunes out of this war. So I don't think it's right to say they shot themselves in the foot as if we are a unit. There's a massive discrepancy in how people are benefiting or suffering because of this dreadful war, a war of choice.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Heard what Mick said. I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling to think one of the richest countries in the world that more and more people have to choose, as he said, between heating or eating. Where do you see this situation going? Because if there's such a disconnect between the ruling class and those who are ruled, do you see, as I was talking to him earlier about a backlash, do you see growing discontent by the British people in dealing with this lack of equality?
Certainly growing discontent. Whether they'll do anything about it, again, is rather a national characteristic. If this was France, you'd have riots. You've certainly had them in Italy. over cost of energy, people burning their energy bills. So the whole idea of privatisation pushed the costs of staples like energy onto people and their individual incomes. And the idea was that you have a much higher income because, hey, neoliberalism and deregulation is going to make everybody much, much richer, and you won't need welfare in 40 years' time. We're now in 40 years' time, and the National Statistical Office published a report last month showing that 25% of Britons were unable to keep themselves warm during November and December. So the incomes haven't risen. The promise of neoliberalism hasn't delivered through. The inequality has. The lack of access to resources and the lack of power. I think the British will put up for it for far too long before they start to revolt, unfortunately. It'd be better off if they behave like the French.
Well, Mick, do you see the role of the Brexit playing anything in all of this? I mean, how has that affected the overall food supply chain, or has it affected it in your perspective?
Oh, for sure. Everyone agrees, apart from the government denialists, that it has affected it to some degree. The question is of whether this is the major factor or there are other even deeper factors. I think Brexit was a profoundly irrational reaction by millions of British people towards the fact that something was wrong with their lives. They didn't like what was happening, and they were encouraged by the current government and its predecessors to think that the EU was the enemy, supposedly. I mean, Boris Johnson, who later became Prime Minister, used to send articles, constant articles from Brussels, fabricating ideas that the EU was about to enforce square tomatoes or straight bananas on the British people. It was madness to a degree. It was profoundly irrational. But I think also now that we have a crisis caused by war, caused by ecological degradation in many parts of Europe, it's not mainly the fault of Brexit. Because of Brexit, of course, the Spaniards, Spanish producers, find it much easier to sell inside the EU than to take the leap of faith and cross the channel and have all sorts of paperwork. And also the Moroccans as well probably find it easier than that. So the EU, it plays a role. Perhaps even more importantly, the Brexit thing was whipping up jingoism against foreigners. Foreigners were the problem. Europeans, but also dark-skinned foreigners, asylum seekers, etc., etc. And it's also profoundly irrational how the British government has created a situation where farmers don't have the skilled labour that they need to harvest the crops. And the latest figures were that millions of pounds, a huge weight of crops has rotted in the field because the farmers got the crops, actually produced them, and then they didn't have the labour to harvest it because British workers won't work for those wages. So you get the irrationality like that. Another irrationality, for example, to show what this country's like, I used to be working out in the university sector, and the government tried to destroy that cash cow because foreign students from China, India, many, many parts of the world had been paying top dollar and had kept many universities afloat. And the British government then, in order to placate their racist rank and file, their electoral base, said that they would reduce this, took steps to make the universities even a hostile environment for students who wanted to come here. So there's a little bit of craziness going on here. But at the end, at the bottom, we find a lot of people suffering a lot and a few people benefiting absolutely overwhelmingly because of the war and the various intertwined crises.
And Steve, how do you see this continuing from here? I mean, if this war continues, we are seeing a limited number of shortages right now in the UK, but do you see the situation exacerbating, and not just in the UK, but throughout Europe?
Oh, it'll be cycles in this. We could easily have a bumper harvest by sheer luck. Southern Californians now have all their water supplies rebuilt by an enormous winter storm that hit Los Angeles. So weird things like that will push us back into a bit of apparent stability for a while. But the overall trend is going to get worse, I think, because we are just now beginning to realize how dependent we are upon oil, and that includes our food. If we didn't have the Haber-Bosch process to make fertilizer out of oil, then we'd only support 2 billion people on this planet, not 8 billion. And if we're being pushed to the point where we can't use that oil anymore, then we're going to find how fragile our systems really are. I think it's just the first taste.
And Mickey, your take on all of this. I mean, it just seems that the so-called elite who are supposed to look at these things and set up equations to see what will equal what, it seems like they really didn't do their job. And as you said, now the average person is suffering. But your prognosis in general of things to come?
Well, I mean, I hear what Steve is saying, that the British are not the French or the Greeks and maybe far too tolerant of what's being done to them compared to other countries. But I'm old enough to remember not when the British government spoke about the French disease, a readiness to strike and a readiness to take on their government to protect their interests. But back in the 70s and 80s of the last century, the French and others spoke about the British disease because the British were very prone to rebellion. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher, we should remember, was forced to resign because of a popular revolt. McDonald's were trashed and riots in London. I mean, riots are as British as apple pie. And the great majority of people, when some anarchists trashed McDonald's, the great majority of people actually said, well, she had it coming. And a few weeks later, Margaret Thatcher was booted out by the Conservative Party, and she couldn't even appear in Britain at Conservative Party events thereafter because of the opprobrium and the hostility that had been generated by a singularly unequal and unfair tax that she had introduced. Now, what we've got is not just a single tax, the poll tax, which the great majority of people hated. We've got multiple versions of that, which vacuum up what wealth there is and suck it up to the top of society and leave people at the bottom worse off than they were the year before. So I think the British have a higher boiling point, shall we say, than other countries. But when they move, they move. And I think everything is set now for very unpredictable futures, shall we say. But it does not preclude a popular political revolt against what's been done to the great majority of people for far too many years.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. We're out of time. Steve Kinn, economist and author out of London, Mick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, I have a very special guest speaker, Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. I would like to thank all the listeners to be part of this session, inshallah.
Inshallah. And we'll have, inshallah, a fruitful discussion regarding one important aspect of the Islamic beliefs, and that is the knowing of the time of the scene of the people by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Of course, Allah is omnipotent. We can say omnipotent. He is all-powerful. He is all-knowledgeable for sure. He knows everything. But if Allah knows exactly the time of the sinning of the people, so what is the fault of the people? And if Allah does not know, so can we say that Allah is incomplete? What's your answer to that?
Okay, so the question has three sects to it. One is regarding the knowledge of Allah, whether it is full, he knows our sins or no.
Yes.
And the other one is the determination of our destination. So like we are predestined to do what we want or no. So regarding the knowledge of Allah, as we know, if we say that Allah doesn't have knowledge of everything that is happening in the world, then it means that there is some kind of lack in that knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is not the case, because if we have a lack in knowledge, then we have a lack in creation and lack in creator. So in that basis, we don't have any kind of issues. We know that Allah's knowledge is complete and supreme, and he is going to have knowledge of our sins or everything that we have. Okay. The second thing is about our determination of action. So here we come to, once we see this question properly, we accumulate to see that another question arises, that how does knowledge of something portray to an action of someone?
That's right.
Yeah. Is knowledge of someone and action of someone else correlated or no?
Okay.
So I would like to move forward, slowly explaining what goes on to understand the question itself and answer.
So you mean a person who has self-knowledge about a fault or an action, does it necessarily get into the practice of action or not? Is it the question?
No. So here, because we are talking about Allah's knowledge, so we are trying to find, for example, now Allah has a knowledge of me going to do something. And I do that. Yes. Is that doing of that something related to Allah's knowledge?
Allah's knowledge or
is
my
kind
my
of force? Or no, it's myself.
Yes.
So there are some points that I would like to mention understand better this point. So the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is complete and absolute, for he is the creator and the knower of knowledge. The Almighty's knowledge of our sin, does it accumulate to our actions, and how it's determined to do so? And when we are forced to do something, is it logical or not? It is logical not to have the capacity to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the best example to it would be if we place ourselves as creations, not in comparison to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but in comparison to what limited we have been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
As creations, I can give examples like manufacturers, engineers.
Yes.
They are creators. They do creations.
Yes.
And of these examples, we see that we have created robots and electronics to do what we want. We give the codes and numbers and everything, and they perceive and do what is given to them as orders.
Okay.
They don't have the capacity of understanding and questioning that order, you see. Then afterwards, maybe you can come and say that they all work due to code given. They have no capacity to do. Some will say that from... some will say that they get hacked and act against what they
were. Their own creator.
Their own creator.
Very much the same as what we see in the movies nowadays.
Yeah.
That they create the robots and the machines have a revolt against their own creators. That's right.
Perfectly. Okay. This is the best example that comes in mind in relation to Allah's knowledge and stuff. And here we see that when the robot was created, he was created with specific laws.
Yes.
You see? But his laws was not limited to this. His laws was limited for maybe doing good, for example, helping out service and everything. But then for future purposes, he was left alone. Like there is a kind of free slot over there.
Yes, yes.
Someone comes, hacks it, as we know, like how hacks and securities work.
Okay.
Someone come, hacks it, and we make the security better so that we fulfill this.
So unlike the robots and the machines, the human beings have the power of free will, isn't it?
Yes.
So they cannot say that every sin, every fault that I do, or I am trapped, for example, by satanic desires, is coming from the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because both the power of goodness, I mean the power of good divinity, and then evil is just, we can say, close to you. So you can use both of them, both ways. But this is you, that upon your own free will, you go on, for example, find the satanic way and not the divine way, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So this is what I wanted to say. By bringing the robot, the engineers, and the creators, I wanted to...